Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Climate Change and Philosophy is a new book edited by Dr. Ruth Irwin. It looks at what is arguably the biggest issue facing us today, climate change, and examines it from a number of philosophical perspectives with the aim of hopefully giving us some fresh solutions. Dr. Irwin joins us now. Well, thank you very much for coming along today. Climate Change and Philosophy, Transformational Possibilities. Now, I've got to be completely honest. I sat down and started to read this over the last few nights, and wow, it's been a long time since I've been at university. My brain just don't work that well anymore. tell me about, now your chapter is about climate change, about finitude, which is again a word that I had to look up. Tell me what your basic hypothesis is.
Well, climate change is presenting probably for the first time in a very real way the end of the modern world. You know, that's what's looming. And my argument is that instead of being afraid of looking at the end of the modern world, that perhaps what we should be doing, a little bit like looking at our own deaths in a very personal way, is that if you can forecast roughly, you know, that you're going to have a 90-year lifespan, let's say, then it gives you a better idea of what you can do during that 90 years. You know, that's what you've got. That's what you landed with. Make the most of it. And it kind of reflects back on what you're doing, say, in your 40s or in your 30s or in your 20s, when you might want to live a healthy lifestyle, in which case you've got 95 years instead of, you know, 92 yep. or something like that. So it's about looking at the fixed period that we are around and contemplating the end point in order to live a better life during the middle of that period.
One of the points you make early on in your article is that out of the vast number of scientists who accept that there's this 2 degrees, this 2 degrees would effectively be where we need to stop, that it was a tiny number of them who actually thought we could achieve that. Mm. Is that sort of like saying, well, you know, you can live to 150 as long as you manage to stay away from every little bit of fat, every little bit of this, you know, we've just gone too far?
That's a very difficult question. I mean, basically, scientists are suggesting, and have been suggesting for a really long time now, that 2 degrees is a 50% likelihood. If we increase the temperature from pre-industrial levels of the entire planet by 2 degrees, then we reach the 50% chance of tipping from climate warming to a huge ice age. So it's actually 2 degrees is like the outside that we can raise the temperature to. If we go beyond that, then the certainty of going from a nice temperate planet like we've had for the last 6,000 years, and in fact we've had for the last 200 million years to a huge degree, that's the Pleistocene era, that will go kablumbi kablooey, it's over, right? So there's a 50% chance of that happening if we reach 2 degrees. Well, right now we're at 1.4 degrees. Okay, from pre-industrial levels. So over the last 250 years, we've increased the temperature of the globe by 1.4 degrees. That gives us 0.6 of a degree left. And given that population is rising at an exponential level still, although it is beginning to slow down, the rise is slowing down, and given that we are very addicted, I'll use that terminology, I think that's the right terminology to use, to fossil fuels, then the chance of us transforming our culture to one that's not as reliant on fossil fuels, that transforms from an economy that's fossil fuel dependent to a low carbon economy or a no carbon economy, is, you know, it's not looking very promising.
Is the extent of the change required? I mean, we've gone well beyond, I think, was what you're saying, the idea of recycling your plastic bottles, and we'll be right. We're talking about basically we've all got to start living like the Na'vi do in Avatar, in order to save humanity. I mean, is that where we're going now?
I think ultimately, probably yes. But that's maybe going to take a couple of hundred years if we do pull that
you
off.
Think?
Yeah. But in the meantime, it's a question of transitioning, not going back to the Stone Age, not attempting to even go back to the horse and cart, because we have, especially in the new world, that is places like New Zealand, Australia, the United States. So not Europe, not these very, very old cities, because old cities are built in a very dense way, so you can walk around them. Whereas new cities like Auckland are incredibly spread out, and so you can't necessarily walk around them. You can't walk from your home to your job because it's too spread out. So it's a question of transforming, using technology, but using clean tech, clean technology instead of fossil fuel dependent technology, to transform our cities into much denser cities, because we are going to need cities. We're looking at 6.7, oh no, it's probably more than that now, but it'll be more than 6.7 billion people on the planet right now. It'll be 7 billion by 2013.
Dense cities seem to be almost the antithesis of what we're looking for. When you think about it, I mean, I can understand maybe what you're saying makes some logical sense, but to many people that would be illogical, wouldn't it? But let's make our cities as dense as all hell. Let's focus all that pollution, all that, you know, carbon all in one place.
Well, if you go to places like Germany, which is a really, really old country, lots and lots of people have been living in Germany for a really, really long time. What they have are very dense cities and then lots of pasture land, lots of green space, and there are no houses out there. So the cities are really dense, and when I say really dense, I don't mean sky-rise buildings like we have.
Those like Hong Kong dense, for
example. Yeah, not necessarily Hong Kong kind of dense, but, you know, six-storey high tenement blocks. So everybody lives on one floor of a tenement. They're really private. You don't see into everybody else's tenement. There's nothing wrong with them. They've been around for a century or more, a couple of centuries, all throughout Europe, in places like Boston. They work really, really well. If we did that kind of medium-density type city, then what you do is you're condensing people so that you run better public transport systems. You don't necessarily, people don't need a car, so they don't even own a car.
Is this something we should do massively, you know, like we should do right now in Auckland? We should say, look, if you're living south of Ellerslie or north of Glenfield, dig up your house. We're going to move you to an apartment and within those confines, that we basically build a wall now and say, okay.
I do think putting city limits on Auckland would be a really good idea. Definitely. I don't think digging up anybody's house is necessarily, it's not necessary.
So you're looking at doing it over time with, as the population grows, confining people to certain
areas. And given that the population is going up to 9 billion by 2050, so that's 40 years, it's going up another third, that's the global population. I think realistically we can look at New Zealand having 20 million people by 2050. Right, there's 4 million here now. I'd say that's a very conservative estimate, actually. So New Zealand, the predictions by things like the Auckland City Council are that Auckland will rise in population to 2 million quite quickly. I think that's actually quite a conservative estimate, because those extra 3 billion people have to go somewhere, and the rest of the world is pretty full. Right? So New Zealand's one of the last fairly open, not open as in our...
we shouldn't be telling people that, I reckon.
Well, I think it's just something we've got to actually face up to, instead of putting our head in the sand and thinking this isn't going to happen.
Australia is heaps more empty than us. just put it out there.
There's no water there. Just to go back to your analogy about sort of the human lifespan and approaching it from this perspective of finitude, it's sort of that approach is sort of designed to alarm us into the action that needs to be taken, right? It's sort of if we see the endpoint as being this definite endpoint, like you were saying about expanding your lifespan by 5 years or something, is that so we all need to sort of be shocked out of our malaise and take much greater action than we are now? Is that sort of what that approach is designed to promote?
Possibly, but I don't think the alarmist function works that well, actually. I mean, what I've written about in that book, and if you look at the introduction, it talks about the Pleistocene era, which lasted 200 million years. Then we moved into the Holocene era, which lasted about 6,000 years. And the Royal Society in Great Britain has just declared that we've moved into the Anthropocene era. And the reason that we've declared this as a new era, Anthropocene, of course, anthro means human. Actually, the Holocene, hollow, is based on human as well. So in a way, why would we change the name of the period that we now live in? Well, the reason for that is that the Holocene was a very temperate, even, you know, mild, lovely place to live. And that's why humans did so well. That's why we've thrived and done so incredibly well over the last 6,000 years. The Anthropocene is looking like a very turbulent, stormy, lots of droughts, you know, very extreme weather conditions, and it could well be a very short period before we switch possibly into a new ice age.
And it's called that because it's trying to assign the blame to us for that?
Well, I don't think assigning the blame is necessarily the right way to think about it. You know, I don't think that some guy who invented the steam engine, you know, back in 1790.
We could blame him.
Well, we could blame him, but I don't think he actually intended to pollute the planet, right? I don't think there's any intentionality there. And we could also blame various generations along the way for not picking up the ball and actually running with it. Well, instead of playing the blame game, why don't we just wake up, smell the roses, and get on with it, doing something about it ourselves, you know?
Brilliant. That seems like a good place to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming along, Dr. Ruth Irwin. The book Climate Change and Philosophy, Transformational Possibilities, available in all good bookstores, is it?
Particularly UBS.
UBS, there we go.
And Fishpond.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Great. Thanks a lot.
That's Dr. Ruth Irwin, and Climate Change and Philosophy is out now. Coming up after the break, we go bodybuilding.